Okay, good evening. Here we are. So we're going to start a session now that's looking at yeast and mammalian cells rather than E. coli to a large extent. Looking at the analysis of genes you make in order to find out something. We'll use definition of promoters as one paradigm for something you might want to find out, and then next time we'll talk about protein-protein interactions. And all of these sort of scenarios will give us a context for discussing many different methods. So we discussed last time the limitations of E. coli as well as its advantages. And I'll talk briefly about yeast and a little bit longer about mammalian cells, and then next time we'll return to yeast when we talk about protein-protein interactions. So in yeast you have you use shuttle vectors, as you use for all vectors and plasmids you make are always able to be grown in E. coli, because that's how you prepare large amounts of them, right? So they're all E. coli vectors and have an AMP and an resistance or some other drug resistance like kanamycin or chloramphenicol resistance, as well as an origin of replication for E. coli. Then for its use in yeast, yeast usually contains a selectable marker so that you can look at integration into the yeast genome and select those cells that have received the plasmid. Either in a free state and providing an enzyme that's missing that's necessary for the yeast to have under certain nutritional conditions. But mostly they're auxotrophies, that is, you grow yeast not in the rich medium, but in a medium lacking an amino acid or a nucleic acid base. And then you provide the missing enzyme, in this case leucine, for leucine biosynthesis. And then you have to provide, of course, a promoter that will work in yeast to get expression. And a terminator in yeast as well, and you put your favorite gene in. So this is a widely used plasmid called a 2-micron plasmid that has this kind of a structure. If you look at integration, homologous recombination is very frequent in yeast, very easy to get, as it is in E. coli, but as it is not in mammalian cells. If you have a good version of one of the histidine biosynthetic pathway enzymes, HIS4, say in this case, and you have a defective HIS4 gene on the chromosome in the genomic DNA, if you get a recombination then between the two homologous genes, this might be different only by a single base pair that's causing this mutation, then you'll integrate the whole plasmid. And so I put this in backwards here because it's going to turn around and be forwards for Y favorite gene here in graphic 2. And so you generate then a functional HIS gene made up partly, depending on the recombination site, partly of the endogenous gene, the good part of the endogenous gene, and the other half or so from the plasmid gene. And the defective gene gets also reconstituted but doesn't contribute anything. Now, although most yeast work takes place either in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is baker's yeast, and that's where most of the genetics have been done, but a strong second is now being used as Saccharomyces pombe, which is quite different from baker's yeast. Baker's yeast, for instance, has very few introns in its genes, whereas Pombe has lots of introns. Pombe is a lot more like higher organisms in that respect. And then there's this yeast, which is Piscia pastoris, which is useful for industrial production of protein therapeutics. It's used for several. I'm not sure actually why this is so much better than the other forms of yeast, but it may be this particular promoter, the alcohol oxidase gene, which you can take advantage of. It's a very strong promoter, and it's under a very tight control. That is, you don't get synthesis until you add the inducer, which is methanol in this case. It's one of the inducers. And so it acts to metabolize methanol. And I think this can make up to about 25% of its protein driven from genes driven by this promoter. So you can put then your favorite gene and attach an alcohol oxidase promoter in the end of it, and then a terminator. And again, there are oxytrolls in Pichia also, which enable you to select for cells that have taken up your gene. Yeah, 30% of total protein. So although yeast doesn't do a lot of the modifications that are present in human proteins, just as E. coli doesn't, on the other hand, they do a lot more than E. coli. And so you get a certain amount of glycosylation, a certain amount of other kinds of modifications in yeast. So it's like better than nothing. So now let's talk about mammalian cells. I mean, for medicine, of course, study of human cells is important, and human tissues, and also for the biotech industry in terms of making human proteins, human or humanized monoclonal antibodies, for example. Most of them are produced in mammalian cells. Which don't have any of the deficits of post-translational modification that we mentioned last time. They're doing everything pretty much okay, especially if you use human cells. But even if you use other mammals or rodent cells, for example, you get a lot of the correct modifications. I should say parenthetically, I haven't prepared any slides for it, that the use of insect cells is sort of another intermediate step that's better than yeast in this respect. They do quite a bit of modification, but they're mainly usually used for transient transfection and relatively small amounts of sort of research amounts of recombinant proteins. But they're used quite a bit for that reason, especially phosphorylated proteins are phosphorylated correctly in Drosophila cells and in mosquito cells. So when we talk about mammalian cells, I want to talk about what is a mammalian cell in culture. So most of the operations we're talking about are genetic operations. So we put in a gene, we select for a cell that's making a lot of one thing. All this involves genetic manipulation and looking at progeny that have done the thing you want and then growing those up. All that takes a lot of growth of these cells. So most experiments use cell lines rather than just cells. So when you say cell line, you mean that it's a clone of cells that came from some organism, some tissue, some tumor, or whatever. It had an origin as a single cell at one point, and it grew up into a population, and that population is propagatable essentially forever, that it's an immortal cell line. So compared to what? Compared to if you take a human tissue, even from a newborn, skin cells, and put them in culture, they will grow very nicely. You give them a good medium. But then after a certain number of generations, they will slowly stop growing and then go through, in fact, some kind of a crisis where they start to look very unhealthy. They become vacuolated and very spread out and very flat. And they stop growing and they die. And this is called cell senescence. So they just get old. And so then if you have to go through several generations in order to isolate some pure clone, then you don't have much growth potential left. So if a typical doubling time or generation time for mammalian cell is of say, one day, which is about the average, then and if it takes one cell to grow into a colony of cells that's visible to the eye, let's say a millimeter in diameter, that's about 1,000 cells. So 1,000 cells is what? It's 10 generations, right? 2 to the 5th is 32, so 2 to the 10th is 1,000, the way I think of it. And then if you want to cover, if you want to grow enough to do something biochemical with, you want 1,000,000 cells, so that's like a dish about this size. So that's another 1,000-fold growth, so that's another 10 generations. Right? So that's 20 generations already. Now, the round number for many human cells put into a culture is about 50 generations, and then they die. So you can do experiments. You can do a few experiments, and people do. But then you have to go back and get new cells. And any gene you put in, you know, is lost. You have to do it all over again, right? Now, from that senescent population, occasionally at some low frequency, you'll have survivors. And these survivors are changed. They've been transformed into an unregulated state and sometimes into an immortal state. You can increase the frequency of this transformation by using genotoxic agents, agents that damage DNA, mutagens, carcinogens, probably all the same thing, either chemical or physical, physical being like radiation, UV, or ionizing radiation like gamma rays or X-rays. And then you'll increase the chance of getting these. You can use viruses also. Certain viruses will increase this chance. And then you could just add genes, just as people are adding genes to make pluripotent stem cells. Just a few genes will do it. And in a sort of a landmark experiment by Han et al. In Bob Weinberg's lab at MIT, they found they could add just three genes and transform a normal human cell into a cell that's both immortal and robust in its growth. And these were oncogenes plus the telomerase gene, which will keep the ends of the chromosomes from shrinking too much during DNA replication. So those were... actually, I think I have this up here. Anyway, so what am I saying? Primary cultures... Mouse cells do the same thing, except they conk out even earlier, maybe 20 generations. On the other hand, they generate more survivors. Reproducibly, you don't have to do anything. You'll get survivors of, say, mouse embryo fibroblasts that will then go on and be transformed in this way. Yes, here it is. RAS, which is an oncogene, cell regulatory gene. SP40T antigen, which also is it's a viral gene that interferes with cell signaling for the cell cycle, and this telomerase. So these cells are not normal. Most of them are aneuploid. So, you know, cells could be haploid, you know, like gametes. There's very few examples of cell lines that are haploid. Or most of our somatic cells are diploid. Some are tetraploid. In the liver. But aneuploid just means not a good ploid. It's something wrong with it. Right? It's not normal. And not only are the number of chromosomes abnormal, but the chromosomes are found to be rearranged. So this is typically what happens also in tumors. So when tumors develop, they go through several changes. And one of those changes, which seems to be important, is a destabilization of the genome that leads to chromosomal rearrangements, that probably just leads to a higher frequency of oncogenes being activated or tumor suppressor genes being knocked out. Usually it's a high number of chromosomes, and sometimes quite variable. The famous HeLa cell line, in some papers, 69 chromosomes instead of 46, which is the normal, or in some papers, 82, depends on which HeLa cells you're using. And often the spread, if you count the chromosomes in mitotic cells, the spread is not narrow, and like a peak for human chromosomes to be 46, and any spread beyond that you can attribute to losses, experimental losses during the spreading process to attach these chromosomes to a slide so you can count them. But in HeLa cells, it seems to be even wider than that, as if they're throwing off variants, losing chromosomes. Well, they have a lot of extra ones, so they can afford to lose some. So mostly we ignore this, and we say we'll learn something about life by studying these odd cells. And it's mostly been true. We've learned a lot. But purists will say, well, you can't believe that. You have to go to real cells. So what are some of these popular cells? This is a long list. Right? It's a short list, actually. And I just picked some examples to indicate why you might choose one cell over another. If you want to use human cells, then you have to use a human cell line. Right? So one of the most popular, as I mentioned already, are these HeLa cells, mostly historical accident, and that they were one of the first cell lines to be established back in, I don't know, 40s or 50, early 50s. And so a lot was learned about them, and so it's nice to be able to go back and then compare to old papers. The other nice thing about them, if you're an RNA person, as I am, is that they have very low RNase activity. So much of work on characterizing RNA is facilitated by these HeLa cells. Human embryonic kidney 293 cells, I don't know how kidney-like they are, but they're originally from the kidney. They're, what they're good for is they have a high transfection efficiency. So you can get up to 100% transfection with something like green fluorescent protein. CHO, or Chinese hamster ovary cells, they're very hardy. They, exceptionally, they don't have extra DNA. In fact, if anything, they have a little less DNA than a diploid cell. They've lost a little bit of their DNA. That's the DNA content. However, they have rearranged their chromosomes, so they are aneuploid in that respect. There's, although there's about a haploid number of normal unrearranged chromosomes. I don't know if that's important. Right? And they were used in the late 60s, early 70s to generate lots of mutant cells. When in early days, when I wasn't quite sure you could even make a mutant in a mammalian cell. Monkey cells, so they're closer to human, primate cells. This particular monkey cell, which is from an African green monkey cell line, is a subline which has, in which the SV40 replication proteins have been put in, so that mainly SV40 large T antigen, so that if you infect these, if you transfect these cells with a plasmid containing the SV40 origin of replication, and we're going to see examples of many of these advantages as we go along. That if you put in a plasmid with the origin of replication, when it gets into these cost cells, it will start replicating and you'll have thousands of copies, enough maybe even to kill the cells. But in a transient experiment, you have a very sensitive way of looking at your gene products in these cost cells. And 3T3 cells, either mouse or human, both called 3T3, you have to distinguish. Sometimes they're called NIH3T3. Those are cells that you're very careful to never let get confluent. So confluent means the cells cover the bottom of a dish. Most of the cells are adherent and grow attached to plastic or glass dishes. And so the 3T3 was like 300,000 cells transferred three times a week. So they never got into a crowded condition, and they never had the incentive, or there was never a selective pressure on them for them to be able to grow in a crowded condition, become unregulated. Right? So you have to treat these carefully if you want to keep them as 3T3 cells. And they're good for looking at conditions that would change them into dysregulated cells. Most of these cells are considered sort of undifferentiated. They don't do anything special, or they probably have some differentiated characteristic that we're not looking at. Others that are more obvious are like baby hamster kidney cells, which make some kidney functions. Actually, I'm not 100% sure of that. But these other ones do. HepG2 cells is a human hepatoma. There's also mouse and rat hepatomas that make metabolic enzymes like aminotransferases that you see pop up on your on your blood tests as an indication of kidney function, large amounts of albumin, which is the most abundant protein in the bloodstream, are made in the liver. pituitary cells that produce peptide hormones like prolactin and growth hormone. Neuronal-like cells from a tumor, PC12, that's mouse. MCF7, which is a human breast cancer line, and there's parallel cell lines that are not cancerous, so that's often used as a comparison between a cancerous and non-cancerous version of the same tissue. HT1080 is another exceptional cell line that has a near diploid karyotype and actually euploid, euploid, so as opposed to aneuploid. So there's very little rearrangement. They might have like one extra chromosome in these HT1086, and they're human. And now, of course, there's a whole new field in the last 10, 15 years that's grown up over pluripotent stem cells, which we won't have time to talk about much. For the purpose of industrial production of therapeutics, which is a big technology area, it's called bioprocess, these four are probably the most common. There's it should be NS0 cells. NS0 cells are mouse plasma cell tumors. So a plasma cell is the terminally differentiated antibody-producing ultimate B cell. So the B cell is dividing, but then it terminally differentiates into a plasma cell, which whose job is just to pump out antibodies. And so for the production of monoclonal antibodies, that seems like a very logical choice. They're full of endoplasmic reticulum. If you look at electron micrographs, and the NS0 cells are the ones in which they are variants of the original cell line that doesn't produce its own anymore. So it's a variant that stopped producing its own monoclonal antibody, and so you can put in your monoclonal antibody, and that's the only thing you'll get. Vero cells is from African green monkey also. It's green. And it's used a lot for vaccines. I'm not sure exactly why. Because, you know, the virus that comes out of it is some attenuated virus. Might have the same kind of coat that's close to human, being from a monkey. Right? But other vaccines are made in chickens. So. CHO cells, also good for monoclonal antibody production. And as we'll discuss in great detail a little later. And these, more recently, these PER6 cells, which have a origin in human retina, but have been established in culture, and also seem to be very good at making a lot of a single protein. So there's some reason to choose, and of course there's hundreds and hundreds of cell lines, all banked in either Europe or United States. You can buy them for a couple of $100, almost any cell line, they'll send it to you. So if you're going to express a gene in a mammalian cell line, we'll talk almost exclusively about lines, but not exclusively, you need certain features, as we said in the East, but we're going to have additional features here. First of all, you need a promoter that's active in mammalian cells, and we'll talk about promoters in a minute. Then you need a cDNA version of your gene because human genes or mammalian genes in general are big and too big to be manipulated as a plasmid, where the practical molecular weight size is about 10 kb. It gets clumsy. Things don't work as well as you get beyond that. And you have to go to cosmids or phagemids. And it's more complicated. So a regular old plasmid is about 10 kb. And so you take the cDNA. You're interested in making the protein. You don't need all those introns. But it turns out that if you do have at least one intron, and it doesn't matter where it's from, it doesn't have to be from the gene that you're studying. It could be from some other gene. And usually better at the 5' end than at the 3' end, the gene gets expressed better. And there's many, many examples of this, and there's some exceptions where it doesn't help. But there's many examples where it does help. And it's still not clear, to me anyway, why it helps. There's been a certain fads of explanation, and first it was thought that, well, you needed the RNA to get out of the nucleus, and that was true for adenoviral mRNA, but not necessarily true for cellular DNA RNAs. Then it was something to do with translation. A few papers said you needed it for translation, and even a paper that said you needed it for stability of the protein that's made from this gene. So it's hard to imagine those mechanisms, although you can come up with possible explanations. So it could be that everything is true, and they have depending on which gene it is and what the promoter and the cDNA and the sequence is, they have different effects. But the practical fact of the matter is, if you put the intron in, you're safer. So that's a good thing to put in. And so you could have a generic 5' UTR with an intron, and followed by then the cDNA and the translational start, and then a poly-A site at the end that's also necessary to get good expression. And usually a strong poly-A site gives you good expression. It's turning out that poly-A sites are generally not so strong, and this is sort of a pretty new field, last maybe 3-4 years, could be that a lot of gene expression is being controlled at the level of polyethylation, but that's yet to be completely pinned down, but it's sort of like making sense. And and so if you put in a strong heterologous poly-A site, then so if you're just interested in a lot of expression, then that's a good idea. Usually SV40 large T antigen poly-A site is used. How about the promoters? So in red here we have the cytomegalovirus early gene promoter, and that's by far the most popular. It's very strong in most cell lines, but not all. In some cell lines it's not strong, but most it is, so that's the one to bet on. It's big and ill-defined. It's like 400 or 500 bases. But it's simple to just stick it in there, and you're pretty assured of good synthesis. Another strong promoter is the SV40 large T antigen promoter, as well as the poly-A site. And that's also strong, maybe not quite as strong, and not quite as universal as the CMV, or widespread. I shouldn't say universal. It's not universal. Rouse sarcoma virus, long terminal repeat, which acts as a promoter in the virus, also works. And you have some specialized one, like a mouse mammary tumor virus promoter, which is inducible by glucocorticoids, like hydrocortisone or dexamethasone, which is the synthetic steroid that works even better. It's not a tremendous induction. It's maybe 5 to 10-fold, but it is an induction, which can be handy. Sometimes you don't want high expression. You can use the herpes simplex virus thymidine kinase promoter, which is slow but steady. Metallothionein promoter is inducible by cadmium. It comes from a gene that's used to detoxify heavy metals. An actin promoter is strong and is present in strong in most cells. EIF2 alpha is a translation factor. Whenever you see EIF, it means eukaryotic initiation factor, and that's talking about initiation of translation, and that's a very strong promoter. And then there's engineered promoters that have sort of artificial promoters that are inducible. TET, which we'll talk about extensively in a minute. Ecdysone, which comes from insects, sensitive to the hormonal changes that trigger metamorphosis from the larvae to the adult. And again, glucocorticoids we already mentioned, right? So TET stands for tetracycline. And why would you want to be in control of your promoter? Well, for production purposes, for example, it could be that the protein you're making, if you make it in large amounts, is toxic to the cells, so you don't get a lot of it. If you try to grow the cells, cells won't grow if they're making a lot of it. So as an alternative, you can grow up 1,000 liters, 10,000 liters of cells, and keep it off, and then turn it on, and the cells start making your protein and go out in a blaze of glory. But meanwhile, you're harvesting the supernatant for this secreted protein. So, and then for research purposes, you might want to see what is the effect of this protein on the cellular phenotype. Where the cells stop growing? Does it affect the cell cycle? Does it affect some other gene turning on? If you turn on a transcription factor, you turn off a transcription factor, a kinase, whatever. So it's very nice to be able to have it in there, turn it on, turn it off. So these are important aspects to promoter design. And the tech promoter itself is such a clever design that it's worth talking about. So this is made mainly from prokaryotic pieces. And I'll have four graphics on this. The first is what's called the TET-off system. And so that means if you add tetracycline, this drug, small molecule, you will turn off the promoter. And it works like this. It's a fusion protein. So it has a two parts. It has the activation domain from herpes virus transcription factor. It's called VP16. And it's a very strong and pretty indiscriminate good activator. If you just get it near a gene, it either attract the RNA polymerase, or if the RNA polymerase is there and poised but not doing anything, it'll, which is the usual, more usual case, it'll kick it off and get started. So now you want to target that. If you want to control the promoter, you want to target it to your favorite gene. So the DNA recognition sequence is then put in as the left-hand side of this fusion protein. It's actually the amino terminal. I believe it is the amino terminal. And for that, Bujold and his collaborators used a bacteriophage gene regulatory protein. And somewhat ironically, they used a repressor. So they're looking for it to actually activate gene expression. They're using the repressor because the repressor, like the LAC repressor, it has sits on an operator and prevents the gene from being in the phage from being on. It's used to control the tetracycline resistance gene. So it's if there's no tetracycline present, there's no need for the phage to make this, so they don't. But if you add tetracycline, then they make it. So normally it's repressed. I hesitate to tell you this whole story because it's all opposite of what we're going to use it for. But this is where its origin was. So normally it's repressed, and it's sitting there. And now you add tetracycline, and it binds to the tetracycline small molecule, binds to a site on this TET repressor domain, and changes the conformation of that domain so that it can no longer bind to the to the DNA. So it's no longer repressed, and the tetracycline resistance enzymes are made. Right? So what Bujold did was just took this modulatable property of DNA binding and turned it around so that in the absence of tetracycline, this guy is going to bind to your promoter. And for a promoter, he used the crippled CMV promoter. He cut off a big chunk of it, saw that it had just almost no activity. It had some activity. This is the background of this. It has some activity, but very little. And if you would only provide it with this VP16 transcription activation domain, then this promoter is back up and strong, just as strong as the original CMV promoter. Right? So you insert the binding site, the operator, and six of them usually, to be safe, for this TET repressor domain in front of your favorite gene, not shown here actually, and it will and it will bring the VP16 then with it, because it's a fusion protein, and you will be on. Right. If you have tetracycline present now, if you add it, now it will deform, it will be on here, active. It'll deform it so it can no longer bind and bring the VP16 to your gene, and so it'll be off, and this is the TET-off system. Now, to do all that, you need a transactivator, which, you need to put this whole gene, this concocted gene, which has a prokaryotic part and a human viral part, into the cells. So you first have to make this cDNA that will code for this, and you have to have it made. So you just put a regular CMV promoter on that. So there's plenty of this TTA. So just to go over it again, here's your six TET operators. Here's your minimum CMV promoter. Here's your favorite gene with this poly A site, probably an intron as well. And just to make things complicated, instead of tetracycline, you use doxycycline because it's better. So since those days when they had, the 90s, when they had tetracycline, they tried different, just like we use amoxicillin instead of penicillin now, they found better drugs. So doxycycline, but we still call it the TET-responsive system just for historical reasons. So when there's no doxycycline, you have the targeting of the TET repressor domain to your new promoter here, and activation of RNA polymerase and plenty of transcription. And then when doxycycline is present, this whole thing gets deformed, can no longer bind, you get off, and that's all you have of these background levels. Looks good, does work. We've spent some time on it. You can buy some of these cell lines, like popular cell lines, like HeLa cells or 293 cells or CHO cells that already have this step already done where you put in this TTA, transactivator, tetracycline responsive transactivator, TTA gene, already integrated and active. They charge you about $800 for that cell line. So we needed a CHO line like that, and my graduate student said, "Oh, don't spend $800. You know, it'd be good for me to do this." I said, "Oh, okay, you're going to save me $800. And then, so he made his own, so we have, in case you ever need it, we have it. Give it to you for free. But then at some point, 2 months later, he said, "Well, how much time did you spend on this? What reagents did you use? And what did it really cost us to make this thing?" Turned out to be more than $800. Right? Now you can then Bujold was not satisfied just with having done that nice, clever thing. He fooled around with this TET-resistant domain even further by making mutants in E. coli and looking for certain properties. And he was able to reverse the whole system to produce a TET-on system. Now he has a mutant version of this TET repressor domain that is deformed so that it can't bind when the tetracycline or doxycycline is not there. And when it binds, now when the doxycycline binds, now it is able to bind. So it's just 180 degrees reversed the molecular effects of adding this small molecule. And so now everything is the opposite. So in the TET-on system, with doxycycline absent, nothing's happening. The VP16 is not brought to the minimal CMV promoter. And now when you add doxycycline, you turn it on. So sometimes you want to turn things on, sometimes you want to turn things off. The kinetics are not that fast. Takes a while. I'm not sure why. So we've used it, for example, in the TET-off system to look at the half-life of mRNA. So we just look at whether it has this poly A site or that poly A site in that experiment and see if it influenced the half-life of the mRNA. So we could shut it off by adding tetracycline and then watch the at various times take points and see how much mRNA was in the cell. You see it goes down exponentially. And one condition, another condition, it goes down faster. So that kind of experiment, we reasoned, was much better than stopping all RNA synthesis, which is a common way. You add a drug like actinomycin that just shuts off all RNA synthesis. But that is so hard on the cell. You're shutting off everything. How's that changing things? Plus, you're adding this chemical that intercalates into RNA as well as DNA. And in fact, when we compared that method with this cleaner gene-specific method, there were big differences. Actinomycin was stabilizing our mRNA. So we never use that anymore. So let's take now this case of when you want to do some experiments to look at, help define the promoter elements. What is the promoter? What are the bases that are necessary for this promoter or for that promoter? So it's not a course now in molecular biology, but we have to put in a few things. Just to get a sort of an overview of the way promoters work in mammalian cells, in mammalian organisms, there's like you can divide them into sort of three regions and three kinds of regulation. First, there's the core promoter region. It seems like you need many of these elements no matter what kind of promoter you have. Right? And these are generally pretty close within 30 bases of the transcriptional start site, which is here. Right? here with this arrow. And there's all these different abbreviations and acronyms. I've given you some of them here, but it's really hard to keep up with them. So you have the INDRA element, which is just spans the transcriptional start site. And there's some sequence specificity in there. You can see it's pretty loose. Here, this is a consensus, right? And then you have things like the downstream promoter element, or DPE, and the BRE, which is that's responding to a particular transcription factor. So there is these transcription-associated factors, which are part of the RNA polymerase transcription initiation complex. There's many different proteins besides RNA polymerase. And these are often called TAFs. So things like the tactile binding protein and the tactile binding protein associated protein, etc. So about half the genes have somewhere in front of them a tactile box, which sort of looks like this. But as we just learned at this seminar I mentioned Monday, sometimes that tactile box is much further than minus 28. And that scientist thought that they were not important, but it didn't really show that if they weren't at minus 28. And very few have it really at minus 28. But the tactile binding protein nevertheless binds upstream of the, right here, this is the complex, these are the TAFs. Upstream of the transcriptional start site by about 30 bases. Then there's a region that often has one of these cat boxes. You have the cat box binding proteins. And then you have others that go way out and could end up, like 3,000 bases upstream. So there's a whole region of, and sometimes they have different names, like locus control element, it's upstream of the globin genes, that's several thousand, and mutations there affect the transcription of the downstream genes. So they're quite complicated. Here's a typical promoter might have a tata box, and then all these different elements, SP1, which is a very common element, cyclic AMP responsive element, and the protein that binds it, cyclic AMP responsive element binding protein, Krebs. OCT1, very important for stem cell differentiation. So they're complicated. So if you want to study that, let's say you want to put your promoter elements into a vector. So you build a vector that has a place to put your promoter just upstream of your gene. If your gene, you're not going to use, say, some kinase or some the actual gene, because it's hard to measure those things. You have to do Western blots, or so it's convenient to put something that you can easily measure and quantify as a reporter of the activity of that promoter. So these are called reporter constructs. And there's a bunch of different reporters that we'll also have a list for, depending on what you want to do. If you want to measure activity, you can put luciferase, for example. It's a very popular one. Luciferase is nice because it produces light of a certain wavelength. You get it either from fireflies that you know produce light. Maybe you're less aware of certain jellyfish that also produce light. I'm not talking about fluorescence now. I'm talking about actually producing flashes of light. You saw it in the pyrosequencing assay. Firefly luciferase is one, and Ranilla, which is the species name for this fish, is another. And the nice thing about those two luciferases is they produce lights of different wavelengths. So by putting filters on your detection apparatus, your luminometer, you can see both of them at the same time. And one could be the control, and one could be the experimental. You make a ratio, and then you don't have to worry about your transfection efficiency, etc. So it's very useful. You can even do these in whole animals. A former student who's now studying metastasis at Baylor, and one of the first, just took this job a couple months ago, and the first thing he asked for was a whole body mouse scanner where you could look at luciferase production anywhere in the mouse, especially where the tumors are, how much light, how big they are. So very powerful. So you insert this upstream of the luciferase, you transfect it in, and then you measure the activity. So what are some of the others? Good old beta-galactosidase. So that cleaves galactose sugars off of things that are attached in a beta configuration to the galactose. So the natural substrate is lactose, which has glucose connected to galactose, and it cleaves the galactose. But you could also have like methyl galactose, and it will cleave the galactose off of that methyl group. Right? And that cleavage reaction now has been so much used over the years that you have even different substrates for the beta-galactosidase depending on what you want to do, and that will be in a subsequent slide. But let's continue along here. Beta-galactosidase has one problem is that there's not much beta-galactosidase in cells, but there is some. And in some cells under certain conditions, I think it's in some one of the, it's either lysosomal or I think it's in lysosomal beta-galactosidase activity. So there's some background. If you want no background, you can take chlorophenicol acetyltransferase. So that's a bacterial gene that provides resistance to chlorophenicol by acetylating it. So chlorophenicol is a drug that inhibits protein synthesis in prokaryotes and in our mitochondria. And if you acetylate it, it's not active anymore, and so the cells have evolved that kind of activity, and that's called CAT. So we have none of that. Right? So there's no background. In this case, you have a radioactive assay, which is very sensitive and very specific. And we'll see an example of that in a minute. Right there. Luciferase I just talked about. Green fluorescent protein invented right here at Columbia by Marty Chalfie. I just bumped into Marty in the elevator. It turns out he was on the what's that show with John Stewart? Daily Show. He was on the Daily Show. So you can go to John Stewart's website. You can go watch that old show, which was just last week, discussing science and politics. But it sounded pretty funny for my elevator conversation. We have green fluorescent protein, then the other varieties of it, mainly made by other people, a blue fluorescent protein, yellow fluorescent protein. Its main claim to fame is visible in living cells. It's visible in living cells. You don't have to fix the cells. And so that provides just this tremendous advantage. And like, got him the Nobel Prize. Not so obvious this would be such a great advantage. I remember he came up and talked to me about this idea. And I said, yeah, you know, we have this protein. This guy
got, and we could just put it in and see these worms, and they all turn green. I say, oh, yeah, it's nice. But, you know. So, we have that insight. Also, using the fluorescent activated cell sorter, which we'll talk about. So these are all, and this is also quantifiable, although there's problems with clean fluorescent protein. He's not here, so I can tell you. There's it has to fold right to be to give you the greenness. It's very pH sensitive. The conditions might be different. If we look at colonies of cells that have green fluorescent protein in them, I'm struck by the fact that how heterogeneous it is. One cell is really bright green, the next one is dim. So it's a little finicky for quantitation. Under quantitation, you're better off with maybe luciferase. But luciferase, you have to put in that assay, ATP, luciferin, a small protein, so you can't do it in living cell. Neomycin, so now we have this little group here, which is drug resistances. So here's a reporter that enables you to take out, to isolate cells that have gotten your construct and integrated it. So you look for resistance to the drug. You don't usually measure the enzyme. You're just interested in having cells that took up your protein because you included this on your plasmid, and then you have to, of course, show that it's doing that, but at least you have the one out of 1,000 or 10,000 that got permanently transfected. A little confusing in that neomycin doesn't work so well in mammalian cells. You have to use this drug called gentisin or G418, but the neomycin phosphotransferase works on this G418, so you use the neo gene to give G418 resistance. And analogously, you have hygromycin resistance, puromycin resistance. All of these inhibit protein synthesis. Histidinol, which sort of indirectly, because it causes starvation for histidine, affects protein synthesis, and zeosin, which is some proprietary thing. I'm not sure how it works. But then there's a protein dear to my heart, which you'll hear over and over again, that dihydrofolate reductase. If you put these into cells that are lacking dihydrofolate reductase, such cells exist in CHO cells, and we isolated them. What these are good for is for gene amplification, and we'll talk about that more in the future. So, and even for this paper you'll read for next time by Michnik, he makes great use of the DHFR in a different way, looking at the protein-protein interactions. And finally, all of these are sort of positive selections. Either you make something or you put in something that allows the cells to grow. Sometimes you want the cells to die if you put it in, or if it's there. And that's a so-called suicide selection. So this can be affected by the herpes virus thymidine kinase, or HSV TK. We have our own TK. All animals have TK, which you give it thymidine, it lets it use it to make DNA. Normally, you don't really need it because you make thymidine monophosphate and triphosphate by a separate biosynthetic pathway. We can all do it, so we don't need this. This is just to salvage thymidine without its phosphate that we might be eating, so it's useful. But what the viral TK does is it will take an analog of thymidine called acyclovir or ganciclovir, and it will also phosphorylate that. Our thymidine kinase doesn't work on that. So the ganciclovir, acyclovir, which looks a little bit like thymidine, looks more like a purine, actually, it doesn't do anything to us. But if you phosphorylate it, then it becomes toxic. And so you can use it against herpes virus. It's the one antiviral that we have against herpes infections. You can take a pill, Valtrex, which is ganciclovir, I think. No, it's valacyclovir. Just variations on the same molecule, and they'll stop the virus from replicating. Here's an example then of a reporter and how it might be used. So this is the CAT assay, chloramphenicol acetyl transferase, and you use radioactive like C14 labeled chloramphenicol. Or you could use radio-labeled acetyl-CoA, which is the acetylating substrate. It gets attached to it, either one. And one way to separate and see whether the reaction is going on is you have to separate the product, the acetyl chloramphenicol, in this case diacetylated, from the substrate, which is just plain chloramphenicol. You could do this by thin layer chromatography, or there are other ways to do it even easier. So you might have certain different cell types, and if you have sort of a special promoter, say in this case the AMG promoter, this is taken from the University of Arizona. There's a lot of nice graphics like this. I think the AMG is just fictional. Not sure. You have a multiple cloning site in front of your cat gene without any promoter. And then if you put in a basic promoter, it doesn't get anything. And if you put it into cell type A with this PAMG promoter, you get nothing. But if you put the CMV promoter in, then you get a lot of activity. And you can cut out these spots and count it in a cell in a radioactivity counter and get quantitative information. You get like both of these to see how how much of the enzyme you're making. Whereas in cell type B, now the AMG promoter is active, even more active than the CMV promoter. So that these two cells are now quite responding quite differently. You have a tissue-specific or cell-specific promoter in hand here. So that's a typical experiment. So we have promoterless, cell-specific, or constitutive. Now, another variable to consider in this experimental designs is even when you have a reporter such as beta-galactosidase, you can use it many different ways. So the simplest way is to measure how much activity you have as the enzyme for galactose splitting activity. Right? So you can put in ortho-nitrophenyl beta-galactoside, and that is something that is almost colorless or slightly yellow. But when the nitrophenol is produced after hydrolysis here, it turns blue. It's much more colorful, right? Stronger color. So you just put it in a spectrophotometer and measure how much blueness you have at 420 nanometers. It's not terrifically sensitive, but it's easy. Or if you want to do a histological assay, you can have a different moiety attached to the galactose. Bromochloroindolyl, that's got a few rings in it, beta-galactoside. That's soluble. It's kind of blue. But but if it's cleaved, then this bromochloroindole—I'm not sure what the product is. Probably indole. That's not soluble, and it precipitates, and so you see these blue particles in the cell. So that's been used a lot, especially in Drosophila. In development, you can see what cells have the beta-galactosidase because they have the right promoter on them. It's only active in nerve cells, only active in retinal cells, etc., because you see this blue precipitate in those cells and not in other cells, also in the mouse. If you want a more sensitive version of just this soluble activity, you can use a fluorescent substrate, a fluorogenic substrate. So umbelliferyl galactose, that's not fluorescent when it's attached to galactose, or very little. But when it's cleaved, it becomes much more fluorescent, just like something else I was talking about earlier. So you measure now fluorescence, which is generally about 100 times more sensitive than spectrophotometry in a colorimetric assay. A fluorescent assay, you can detect much smaller amounts of the product. And to go even further, you can use a chemiluminescent product. It's even more complicated. We always call it galacton star. They have various proprietary names. When they get cleaved, it together with a bunch of other reagents, including another enzyme that's present in the mixture, you get luminescence. It's not bioluminescence like luciferase, but it's chemiluminescence, just a chemical reaction. And so if you and so this is very useful for like Western blots. And so usually used for Western blots where you can have an enzyme that cleaves a substrate, produces a chemiluminescent product, and you can catch that chemiluminescence on X-ray film in just a few minutes of exposure, or if you have very little signal, you can leave it overnight and you get a spot in which you can quantify also. So you see, with the same enzyme, right, you can use it in very different ways. And finally, almost never used, is its ability to cleave lactose. So that's used, could use in E. coli, but I've never seen it actually used in mammalian cells, give lactose instead of glucose and see if they could use it. Usually just for microbial cells. So that would be more like drug resistance or auxotrophy. Oh, let me get to it. So the kind of experiment you can do is a sort of promoter bashing, it's called. And you can, the simplest thing is you just make deletions. You have a bunch of restriction sites, so you make various constructs that are chopped in from the left end, say, here. And then you look at the luciferase activity, let's say. And it goes from down fivefold when you cut off this region with the KNS sites. And so you know there's something important out there. And then you cut off a little more, nothing happens. And you cut off some more, and it goes down another 20-fold, so you know there's something important over here. And then you can start putting things back. And indeed, when you put this XHO1 to SMA fragment back in, you go from 480 back to 2500. and you can narrow it down to just this KPN SMA fragment. Also gives you that. So you know there's something important out here. There's an enhancer element. You can map it. And there's something close in over here. So these kinds of experiments. I already talked about encyclopedia. But where that's used most often, this HSVTK suicide reporter, is if you say... have integrated between some site-specific recombination sites. One version of which is called LOX. It's the most popular. If you put in a recombinase from E. coli called Cre, that will stimulate recombination between two LOX sites. And so you can pop out this thing. So you can select for it specifically the popping out by including a suicide gene in there. So then if you're making a recombinant mouse, for example, this is very handy. So you can have your guy in there, and then you can see what happens when you take it out. And you can take it out at various times in development by putting the recombinase under control of some tissue-specific promoter. All right, that's a mouthful. Anyway, it's useful. You can also, you know, substitute in, put in something with two LOX sites, and you want to substitute for the wild type, the mutant protein. How do you know if you have it in there? Maybe the mutant is better than the wild type. You can select for something, or maybe it's worse. So it's good to put it in without bias. So you can select for the replacement of this region by selecting for resistance to ganciclovir, because the loss of the TK gene. So that's handy. We're doing experiments of that type. That's called cassette exchange, when there's two LOX sites and you're replacing both of them. Okay, we're going to now, since we're talking about promoters and we talked about sort of the genetic mapping of the elements on there, so it seemed appropriate to bring in other ways of looking at promoters from the point of view not of activity but of where the transcription factor binds. So that's mapping the the actual binding sites for a DNA binding protein in general, usually a transcription factor, but not always, on the DNA. So a very nice method for that is called footprinting, and it works by taking say a naked DNA versus DNA which you've exposed to your, say, purified or maybe even not purified, just a nuclear extract even, but works best for a purified transcription factor. So you do two experiments. In both of them you treat it with DNase 1, which cuts not entirely randomly at all, but it cuts a lot of places, and so this has no protection for this cleavage. I don't know what these two things are here. has no protection against this cleavage, whereas this guy should be protected from cleavage because it's made that little region where it's bound inaccessible to this nuclease. So since DNA cleaves at a lot of places, you're going to get a whole bunch of small things. You use partial, otherwise you just get a bunch of nucleotides. So you have to do trial and error, and you generate a ladder of different sizes just by chance, and they show up like this. Just a ladder of different sizes in the control, whereas the sample of DNA, which and this is radioactive DNA, so you can see small amounts. And then the ones that had bound the DNA binding protein will be protected in a certain region where it's bound. So that's called the footprint. So the actual data looks like this. For one thing, this is the control over in these lanes here. You can see there's already like footprints. They're not really footprints. They're showing the specificity of DNase 1. So it's just not cutting the sequence in here very well. In other sequences, it cuts really well. And others, intermediate. So that's your standard. But clearly, you can see in these experimentals that there's a giant window here. It's a particularly clean example. There's like almost nothing there. Complete protection. If you have a protein that's binding to this region K, and another protein binding L, right? And then J is unconvincing because even the controls don't have anything down there. But these two are very clear. The more popular, because it's easier, kind of experiment is a gel shift, but it doesn't give you as detailed information. In the gel shift, you take your radioactively labeled double-stranded DNA that has this hexagonal DNA element. Looks like a protein, but don't be fooled. This is just University of Arizona's way of doing it. Never got around to making my own diagram. So here's the element, and here's your DNA binding protein that fits that element. So when that's bound, if you looked at if you electrophorese now these say just the free unbound radioactive DNA, it will come down here because you run it so that it runs down to near the end. But if it has this protein bound to it, it's going to be slowed down. So to the extent that some molecules have the protein bound, it'll be shifted. The electrophoretic mobility will be shifted to be less mobile, right. Slower. And so that's evidence that perhaps your protein is bound to that DNA. And if you put in more of it, then more of your protein, then more of it is shifted. So that gives you some confidence that it's specific. And if you will add unlabeled, non-radioactive, say 10 times more non-radioactive, then that will soak up a lot of that protein and should make the binding to the radioactive one less efficient. And so you see that, in fact, this goes down, and that gives you some confidence. Not shown here, but shown on the next slide, is if you took some DNA that wasn't the unlabeled version of this, but some other DNA, and it also competed with it, and it's like, well, it's not very specific for this sequence. It's just maybe the ends of the, maybe just the end of any DNA will be binding this protein. So that's a control that's almost that you have to run to show that your binding is specific. Yeah.
Is the DNA fragmented, or is this like pulse field
control? The DNA is usually like a PCR product, just small, 50, 100, something like that, or even less. So you have to have a pretty good idea where you want to look to begin with. Actual data then looks like this. Here there's a case where they see an intermediate band, they think that there's two molecules of the protein bound for a DNA element. And here shows this competition that I was talking about. So in the first lane we just have, this is now an extract, not even a purified protein, and it's shifting this up. And it's giving two bands, a major band and a minor band. Now, if you have some, so you say, what is this protein? You say, well, I think it's such and such. And I can get an antibody to that. You can get an antibody to almost anything commercially nowadays. Right? So you buy yourself some antibody against your three best guesses. You can afford it. And one of them, in fact, now when you have the antibody present against that protein. If it really is that protein, now you have even a bigger protein complex on the DNA fragment, so the mobility is going to be affected even more. And not only do you get a shift, you get a super shift. So it's called a super shift, and it means that that antibody is reacting to the protein that's bound to that DNA, and so you've identified your DNA binding protein. Now if you put in excess specific probe, it all goes away, as it should. But if you put in a non-specific probe, then it doesn't affect the super shifted guy, plus the antibody. Extract plus the antibody plus unlabeled non-specific oligomer. But this minor guy, he went away. So we don't have to worry about the minor guy. That was just some funny business that didn't have to do with this particular sequence. Just maybe, again, there are these DNA molecules, there are these proteins that bind the ends of DNA molecules, for instance. Well, 28 out of 39, if I finish this, I got 5 minutes. This is CLEX. It's another way to look at the binding specificity of a particular protein, but from the other way around. In the EMSA, or gel shift, we're looking at trying to identify the protein on the basis of a known target. We can also turn it around and say, I have my transcription factor. It has a particular target. That's how I discovered it for my favorite gene here. But I want to know what other genes in the human genome. What other are there possibly regulating other things? What is its binding specificity? What does it bind best to? So the CLEX is an experiment that varies a huge number of possible sequences and picks out the ones that bind to your protein the best. So just to make it a little more complicated, you can do it for DNA, or you can do it for RNA as well. You're also interested in RNA binding proteins. It affects splicing and stability and translation, all kinds of interesting things RNA do, and they're mediated by RNA binding proteins. So just to make it more complicated, we'll show you here that it can also be done for RNA as well as DNA. So here's the procedure. First, you order a random, say, let's just say a 21-mer. That's 4 to the 21 different sequences. So that's a large number of sequences. It's 10 to the 14th different sequences. This is a practical limit, in fact, unless you want to spend thousands of dollars. But for hundreds of dollars, you can get enough micrograms, about 1 microgram, instead of like nanograms, you know, of random 21-mer. Okay, maybe it has 20 bases on either side for PCR purposes, right? But the region in the middle could be 21, and that would give you 10 to the 14th. That's a very, very large number. So this is your pool. You've included in this flank of this 21-mer a T7 transcription sequence, which is 18 bases. So T7 polymerase, which you can buy, you mix it with this double-stranded DNA. You have to make it double-stranded because you get it single-stranded, but you can essentially just copy it. Not just copy it, but you can copy it. Then you get from that RNA, made from this double-stranded RNA. Now you mix this and put it, you have your protein stuck to some beads in a column, and you pour this over it nice and slowly, let it run through, and you throw out what runs through, you wash it, and then you elute the RNA, say, with heat. Right? So that'll denature the protein, and the RNA will come out. So you throw away the non-binding species, and you have elution of the binding species. So you're enriched. You might think, well, I'm pure now, just the stuff that bound. But you're way off from pure because you had 10 to the 14th different sequences. How efficient is this column? The plastic is binding stuff. The beads themselves, non-specifically, will bind some RNA. So the RNA just stuck in the interstices between the beads. If you do 99%, I mean, that's fairly terrible, but it's quite possible. You're only getting rid of 99% of the non-spices. And maybe only 100 sequences out of this 10 to the 14th bind. So your fraction is, say, 10 to the minus 12th. Now, after 100-fold purification, you're still at 10 to the minus 10th. But it's okay because we're going to go in circles here. Right? So we have enriched species. Now we have, this is RNA. You use reverse transcriptase, you make single-stranded cDNA from it. And then you do a PCR of that single-stranded cDNA. And on the PCR, the RNA doesn't have that T7 polymerase binding site anymore because it starts after that to make the RNA. So you regenerate it. It's easy. You regenerate it, build it into your primer. So now you're back to double-stranded DNA, and then you just repeat the whole experiment. Make RNA from that using that reconstituted T7 promoter. You put it through again. Now you get 100-fold purification again. You're 10 to the minus 8th. Do it again. You're 10 to the minus 6th. Do it again, 10 to the minus 4th. 10 to the minus 2 should be all the way there after 6 cycles. So CLEX is this iterative, repeated thing. We have competition going on all the time to pick out the guys that bind best. At the end, then, when you might try it after 4 cycles, see what's happened. You just clone a bunch of these and sequence them and see if you get some kind of common sequence. So in this experiment with RNA, it was binding PUM2, which is a puff protein, which is supposed to control RNA stability. And indeed, you see some commonalities, and yet, you know, quite a bit of flexibility in what it binds. This topic of binding specificity of nucleic acid binding proteins is still fairly murky and a subject of much study. So, but this at least gives you a list of about 20 to go with, and from that you make a consensus site. You know, I put this in just for your reference. I'm always forgetting what these odd letters mean. You know, N means anything. All right, R we all know means purine, but B, what's B? And there's actually a mnemonic about it, which you can study over here to help you remember what is B and what is K and what is S. So it means ambiguous positions. Okay, so next time we'll look at how we look at RNA products rather than protein products of genes to look at gene expression. And...